content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the September 2022 issue of Smithsonian Magazine. And we'll begin with an article titled, "The Forever Legend," by Joshua Hammer. The story of Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table has captivated us for 1,000 years. But was the heroic British monarch a real person? New research is reviving the debate. A cold, wind-driven rain soaks through my parka as I walk across a narrow footbridge that links the Cornwall mainland in southwest England to a rocky promontory overlooking the Bristol Channel. Far below this cantilevered span, waves crash against the cliffs and swirl inside a grotto known as Merlin's Cave. Winscott, a burly, amiable archaeologist from nearby Devon, opens a gate and leads me down a path to the ruins of a medieval castle. Its fragmentary walls mark the lair where Richard, the 13th century Earl of Cornwall, and the brother of King Henry III, is said to have gathered with his followers to feast on mutton and ale and pay homage to a monarch who may have never existed, King Arthur. The figure of Arthur first appeared in Welsh poetry in the late 6th and early 7th centuries, a hero who was said to lead the Britons in battle against Saxon invaders. But it wasn't until the 12th century that he was first tied to this dramatic headland, known as Tintagel. In the Welsh cleric Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, which was written in 1136 and purported to trace Britain's history back to its supposed founding by Trojan exiles, an almost certainly fictitious 6th-century British king named Uther Pendragon sleeps at the beguiling Ygerne, the wife of a local duke, at her castle in Tintagel, after the magician Merlin turns Pendragon into the likeness of her husband. That night she conceived Arthur, the most famous of men, who subsequently won great renown by his astounding bravery, Geoffrey wrote. Scholars have universally dismissed Geoffrey's text as a pseudo-history, woven from ancient Welsh folk tales and his febrile imagination. Still, many people at the time believed the story, and Richard, Earl of Cornwall, was so convinced Arthur was real that in May 1233, he traded 3 prime estates for this treeless headland, which is separated from the mainland by an isthmus, and built a castle on it. It had no function, Scott says, as he leads me through the stone ruins of the castle's great hall. It is in a remote part of Cornwall that had no use to him, but he wanted to anchor his position in legend and history. He was the Earl of Cornwall, but he was also the successor of Arthur. King Arthur has never relinquished his hold on the imagination. Writers in Geoffrey's wake added their own flourishes, the magical sword Excalibur, the Knights of the Round Table, Arthur's romantic triangle with Queen Guinevere and Sir Lancelot, and Arthur's mortal wound at the Battle of Camlann. Arthurian tales of courtly love, magic, and martial bravery have been told and retold in countless versions over the centuries. From the earliest eulogistic stanzas in Welsh poetry to T.H. White's 1958 novel, The Once and Future King, from Sir Thomas Malory's 15th century Le Mort d'Arthur to the 2021 film The Green Knight, starring Dev Patel as Sir Gawain, a knight at Camelot, the legendary castle where Arthur held his court. There is something in the Arthur legend for everyone, says Leah Tether, a professor of medieval studies at Bristol University and former president of the British branch of the International Arthurian Society, which regularly brings together scholars and other enthusiasts and interested in Arthurian literature. The story of King Arthur, she says, has got flawed characters with whom we can empathize, quests to achieve impossible goals, and an adaptable storyline that fits the socio-political landscape of the time. Raluca Radulescu, a professor of medieval literature at Bangor University in Wales, suggests Arthur's perennial appeal is also tied to a standard of moral integrity that readers find inspirational, one they cannot find in the world around them, but will discover in the stories of King Arthur. The timeless popularity of the Arthur legend has overshadowed a central, unresolved question. Was there really a King Arthur, or at least a historical prototype upon whom Geoffrey's hero is based? That's what has brought me to Tintagel on this stormy winter morning. Scut leads me down a grassy slope to the foundations of a dozen houses built on terraces overlooking the sea. Raleigh Radford, the English archaeologist who exposed these ruins in the 1930s, was reminded of similar structures at remote sites in Ireland. And after observing Christian symbols on ceramics found at the site, he guessed the ruins were the remains of a Celtic monastery that existed between the 5th and 7th centuries. Over the past 5 years, however, Scut and his team from English Heritage, a nonprofit organization that administers more than 400 historical sites in Britain, have conducted their own research, and they've challenged Radford's assessment of the site. They have excavated three additional structures and have also unearthed fragments of glass goblets from Spain, cups from Merovingian-era France, pottery from Tunisia, and amphorae likely from Turkey used for storing wine or olive oil. Carbon dating, unavailable to Radford a century before, has confirmed the settlement existed in the 6th century. But rather than being a retreat for religious ascetics, Scut believes that the site, with its protected position on the Cornwall coast, was a flourishing local stronghold. This could have been home to a mercantile elite whose economy was based entirely on trade, he says. Tintagel, Scut says, was likely home to hundreds or even thousands of people and controlled a territory that extended across modern-day Cornwall. He points out that while much of the British Isles had sunk into illiteracy and destitution during this period, commonly known as the Dark Ages, most residents at Tintagel lived in comfortable slate-roofed homes with sturdy wooden timbers and, in some cases, a second story. It's not implausible, he argues, that a ruler or commander, perhaps one named Arthur, rose out of this society and served as an inspiration for Geoffrey of Monmouth. The headland has given up other tantalizing clues, including a 6th century stone slab with the mysterious word Artognou carved into it. That's A-R-T-O-G-N-O-U. Experts in Celtic, the language spoken in Britain at the time, dismiss its significance. But some insist the inscription is a variation of Arthur. The slab, they say, is a mark of the king's realm. When the legend of Arthur was born, Britain was in a state of collapse. The Roman Empire has made its first incursion into the British Isles in 55 BC, eventually conquering much of the territory up to present-day Scotland. Its conquest and long rule was often violent, but the Romans also built roads and established towns such as Londinium and Durovernum Canticorum, today London and Canterbury. Throughout the Roman province of Britannia, the quality of life largely improved. Then in AD 410, Rome, under siege at home from the Visigoths, a Germanic tribe from Eastern Europe, withdrew its troops and plunged Britannia into chaos. Civil institutions vanished, the economy collapsed, and basic household goods became scarce. Saxon invasions terrorized the population, and Britannia fragmented into fiefdoms dominated by often brutal strongmen and their gangs. Britain has kings, but they are tyrants, engaged in plunder and rape, but always preying on the innocent. a British monk named Gildas wrote in the 6th century. Famine and plague struck the region, wiping out a significant part of the population. Britain was a failed state, says Mark Morris, a British historian, author of 2021's The Anglo-Saxons, A History of the Beginnings of England, 400 to 1066. People would have perished in the hundreds of thousands. It was a miserable time to be alive. Many historians believe that a heroic warrior likely rose during the period to lead the Britons, who had largely embraced Christianity, against the pagan Saxons. The Welsh poem, Y Gododin, written between AD 540 and 640, describes a fallen soldier by likening him to another called Arthur, which some scholars interpret as showing that a warrior named Arthur was so famous when the poem was written that the bravery of others could be measured by comparison. Around the same time, Gildas, the monk, described a British triumph at the Battle of Badon Hill, which he dated to the year of my birth, probably in the early 6th century. He doesn't mention Arthur. He called his hero Ambrosius Orellanus, but 3 centuries later, around 830, a Welsh monk named Nennius, in his History of the Britons, described how a warrior named Arthur led the Britons to victory in 12 glorious battles against the Saxons. The 12th battle was on the mountain of Badon, in which there fell, in one day, 960 men from one charge of Arthur, and no one slew them except him alone, and in all battles he was the victor, Nennius wrote. Some scholars have pointed to Nennius' account as evidence of Arthur's existence. Yet Nicholas Higham, a retired medievalist at the University of Manchester, and the author of 2018's King Arthur, The Making of a Legend, says the evidence is hardly conclusive. For one thing, the account was written 300 years after the Battle of Badon Hill was purported to take place. Although Gildas's text provides only contemporaneous mention of the battle, other British histories, including the 8th century Ecclesiastical History of the English People, describe the fighting in detail, and scholars are generally convinced that such a battle did take place. For another, historians in the Middle Ages are known to have blended fact and fiction to advance a political or religious agenda. At a time when the Saxons were conquering Britain, Higham says, the Britons needed a God-beloved warrior to rally their spirits and restore the emergent nation to glory, and Nennius concocted a character to fit the bill. Arthur was winning battles with the support of Jesus Christ and Mary against the Saxons, he says. The Saxons were presented as barbaric, dishonest, and late coming to Christianity. To show that Arthur had roots in Roman culture, which was still widely admired, Higham argues, Nennius derived his name from Artorius, a general who gained fame in the Punic Wars in the 3rd century BC. If Nennius established Arthur as a British hero, Geoffrey of Monmouth brought him to life. Born around 1090, possibly in Wales, and educated in Paris and Oxford, Geoffrey was ensconced as a bishop in Britain in the mid-1100s when he wrote, in Latin, perhaps the most influential book ever about Arthur. Like Nennius, Geoffrey had a political agenda to show the superiority of the Celtic-speaking Britons, and by extension, the Welsh, who spoke the same language. There were a lot of criticisms of the Welsh as being savages, barbarians, says Morris. Geoffrey invents a noble history for them, going back 100 kings before Arthur. A cipher in Nennius' history, Arthur now became a Celtic-speaking warrior king within a richly imagined narrative. Geoffrey claimed that he gleaned the details of Arthur's life from an ancient Welsh history book shown to him by an Oxford archdeacon, but there's no such evidence that such a book existed. There's also no knowledge about what might have led him to set Arthur's origin story at Tintagel, or if he ever visited the remote headland. He would have known it was a very dramatic, rocky clifftop, a mystical place, a place that there were plenty of stories about, says Higham. But that's all we can say. Jeffrey introduced Guinevere's infidelity to Arthur, the wizard Merlin, a composite of early Welsh prophets, and a magical sword he called Caliburn, based on the Irish sword Caladbolg, a derivation of the Welsh Caladefwch, which later became known as Excalibur. He ended the tale on an island called Avalon, where Arthur is carried by the enchantress Morgan le Fay after being mortally injured against the Saxons in the Battle of Camlann. Geoffrey apparently plucked this battle from the Welsh Annals, written in the late 10th century. This set of chronicles, an apparent blend of fact and fiction, established A.D. 537 as the year of the Battle of Camlann, in which Arthur and Medrawt, or Mordred, who in later Arthurian tales becomes Arthur's treacherous nephew and rival, fell, and there was a plague in Britain and Ireland. Geoffrey's fantastical account had its share of skeptics. It is quite clear that everything this man wrote about Arthur and his successors, and indeed his predecessors, was made up. The medieval historian William of Newburgh wrote, "Yet many Britons accepted it as truth. In 1191, the monks of Glastonbury Abbey dug up a pair of skeletons in their churchyard and touted them as the remains of King Arthur and Queen Guinevere, a clever hoax to draw paying tourists to the abbey." By the 13th century, writes Morris, in 2015's A Great and Terrible King, Edward I and the Foraging of Britain, it was proof positive that the fabulous king about whom Geoffrey of Monmouth had written had once really existed. One true believer was King Edward I. In 1278, the monarch visited the gravesite at Glastonbury and ordered the remains to be disinterred, partly to lay to rest the beliefs in some quarters that Geoffrey's hero was superhuman and still alive, and thus could potentially challenge Edward for the throne. There, in two caskets, were found the bones of the said king of wondrous size, and those of Guinevere a marvelous beauty, wrote a local observer. Afterward, the king and queen wrapped the skeletons in silk, placed the royal seal on them, and returned them to their graves. From this point, the Arthur legend not only grew, but became the dominant literary tale of medieval Europe. Monasteries and royal courts bought more than 1,000 copies of Geoffrey's manuscript, making it the most popular text in the Middle Ages after the Bible. Richard Barber, an Arthurian scholar in Sussex, has personally tracked down 235 surviving copies. He might have found more, but when Henry VIII shuttered the country's monasteries in the late 1530s, during his break with the Roman Church, a lot of them were torn up and used for wrapping pies, Barber told me. Meanwhile, the legend of King Arthur traveled across the channel to France, thanks to the hugely influential 12th century French poet Chrétien de Troyes. Possibly borrowing from Geoffrey of Monmouth and from Welsh folk tales, and writing under the patronage of the Plantagenets, the British-French dynasty founded by Henry II, de Troyes invented Sir Lancelot, Camelot, and the Holy Grail, which he described as a vessel used by Jesus at the Last Supper. The Arthur story began to take off, says Barber. 100 years later, you've got Arthur in Germany and all around Italy. Manuscripts retelling the Arthur myth became so common that they were often discarded and recycled, and not only as pie wrapping paper. One winter morning, I visited the rare book room at Bristol Central Library with Leah Tether, the University of Bristol medievalist. A library staff member brings us four leather-bound tomes written by the French philosopher Jean Gerson and printed in Strasbourg in the late 15th century. But what we're really here to see is something that in 2019, one of Tether's colleagues discovered pasted inside the bindings. Seven parchment manuscript pages written in Old French, dating to around 1250. These pages, discarded and recycled as protective filler inside the newer volumes, show how the Arthur legend took on embellishments and mutations as it proliferated across Europe, introducing new characters, developing storylines, and reflecting the mores and culture of the different societies in which it appeared. The Seven Pages came from a series of French stories known as the Vulgate Cycle, and they constitute some of the oldest known adaptations of tales by Chrétien de Troyes. I scanned the 1,000-year-old parchment and spot references to Merlin and Galvain, the French spelling of Sir Gawain. Here, Tether says, Merlin advises Arthur on military tactics, leads a charge using a dragon standard that breathes real fire, and engages in an amorous encounter with Vivien, otherwise known as the Lady of the Lake, a fairy queen invented by de Troyes and further developed by later French writers. This version, says Tether, is more chaste than the standard French medieval accounts of the relationship, which describe a spell written across Vivienne's groin that prevents men from sleeping with her. In this early version, the spell is written on her ring and prevents men from speaking with her. Very little is known about de Troyes' life, but he's the ultimate medieval storyteller, Tether tells me. His stories were translated into Old Norse and Swedish, the latter, Tether says, inscribed on doors across Iceland in the 12th century. Other writers added their own touches to the Arthur story and canonized his place in literary history. Thomas Malory, a British member of Parliament and a violent criminal who probably wrote Le Mort d'Arthur while doing time in Newgate Prison for robbery or rape, created the definitive version of the Sword and the Stone story. In his account, the teenage Arthur answers a challenge inscribed on the stone. Whoso pulleth out the sword of this stone and anvil is rightwise king born of all England. By performing the feat multiple times after other nobles have failed. 4 centuries later, Alfred, Lord Tennyson, in Idylls of the King, described the tortured romantic triangle involving Arthur, Lancelot, and Guinevere that tore apart the Knights of the Round Table. The great and guilty love he bare the queen, in battle with the love he bare his lord, had marred his face and marked it ere his time, he wrote. Tennyson also brought the story full circle. The Victorian poet described the waves of the Bristol Channel carrying the infant Arthur, an abandoned castaway, to the shore of Tintagel. There Merlin stashes him in the grotto, now known as Merlin's Cave, to protect him from the enemies of his father, Uther Pendragon. As he had from the beginning, Arthur remained a source of legitimacy for Britain's ruling elite. Where early medieval legends sought to cast Celtic-speaking Britons favorably, the Tudor monarchs who came to power in the late 15th century claimed Arthur as a direct ancestor, deriving from him the right to rule the nation. Henry VII even baptized his son Prince Arthur, and for writers, he remained the ideal vessel into which they could pour their social commentary. Tennyson, writing during the upheavals of the Industrial Revolution, portrayed Arthur as a figure of moral stability and certainty, whereas Guinevere, in the light of Victorian morality, was an adulterer whose transgressions contributed to the general sickness of society. The interesting thing about the Arthurian legend is that it has periods of both ebb and flow, says Tether. It's able to be molded to fit with current preoccupations, such that it can find applicability no matter what the mood of the moment. She points out that the elasticity of the narrative has its roots in the Middle Ages. Stories were transmitted orally and via manuscripts, meaning that no two versions were identical. It's actually impossible to identify an original version of Arthur. Arthur's appeal is, and always was, precisely in his multiplicity. In and around Tintagel, the legend of Geoffrey of Monmouth's Arthur continues to draw pilgrims to the king's realm. The Earl of Cornwall's 13th century stronghold receives 250,000 tourists a year, including 3,000 a day in the summer. Many, says Winscott, believe that they're seeing King Arthur's castle. Critics say English Heritage has fed the misconception since taking over the site in 2015. In 2016, 200 Cornish historians criticized the group for turning the castle into a fairy tale theme park by erecting kitschy monuments, such as a Merlin relief carved into stone near the grotto. Scott replies that his organization has made it clear that the castle is Richard's, not Arthur's. But he adds, there was a great mythology to this site that was denied up to this point. The theme park atmosphere carries over the modern village of Tintagel on the Cornish mainland. Visitors can spend the night at the hulking Camelot Castle Hotel, hunt for souvenirs at the Pendragon gift shop, or grab a pint and a Cornish pasty, a traditional crescent-shaped pie filled with meat, at King Arthur's Arms Inn. Tour guides in North Cornwall, meanwhile, promote several sites, claiming the places may have been frequented by King Arthur and his knights. There's a pair of mysterious labyrinth symbols carved into a stone in the forest, supposedly during the early Bronze Age. Skeptics say they were likelier carved by local mill workers in the 1800s. A Neolithic stone enclosure on the Erie Bodmin Moor that some say was an Arthurian ceremonial site, and St. Nectan's Glen, a mossy waterfall where Arthur's knights are said to have cleansed themselves before setting off to find the Holy Grail. Matt Ward, a manager at St. Nectan's and previously property manager of Tintagel Castle, says he's convinced there's something to the Arthur story. "I think Geoffrey of Monmouth heard about Tintagel from people at the time," he tells me. "They told him there were powerful people up there, kings." We will finish this article on our next program. So we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.